This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It started the day ranked number 188 on Amazon. By late afternoon, it was up to 30. Not bad, really, for a government document. But why buy the financial crisis report when we already know how the story ends? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by iShares Exchange Traded Funds. Learn more about their ETFs at 1-800-iShares or iShares.com. iShares, keep evolving. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 27th of January today. Good to have you with us. The National Commission on the Causes of the Financial and Economic Crisis released its findings today. Its main conclusion is that the crisis was, drumroll, please, avoidable. Four members of the panel dissented from the report, but after more than a year of inquiry and interviews with some 700 people, the government's official verdict on the financial crisis doesn't really tell us an awful lot we don't already know, and it doesn't give us much to go on. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Business executive John Thompson is a member of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
I think we have a reservoir of facts that is the most complete view of what has happened.
He says the group did exactly what Congress told it to.
We were asked to determine what were the causes of the financial crisis and why were those causes allowed to occur.
Among the unsurprising findings in today's report, regulators didn't do what they were supposed to. There was a lack of transparency. Investors behaved unethically. And credit rating agencies failed. The final report was written by six Democrats. All four Republicans on the commission dissented. Douglas Holtz-Aiken was one of them.
As we said in our writing, if everything explains the financial crisis, then in the end, nothing does.
He says the group had its own management failures.
To use the staff effectively, investigate the right kinds of things, get the commissioners focused on coming to conclusions, we wasted a lot of time and money as a result.
After 18 months and almost $10 million, critics say it needed more time, more money, and more specialists. Lawrence McDonald was interviewed several times. He traded credit default swaps for Lehman Brothers, then wrote a book about it called A Colossal Failure of Common Sense.
And I'm disappointed that they didn't have more financial people, at least on the phone with me.
Like many, McDonald said he wanted answers, people held accountable. And in this reservoir of facts, he didn't find them. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The Treasury Department announced this week it's made a tidy profit on its Citigroup investment, more than $12 billion, in fact. Investment, of course, is another way to say TARP. And in fact, the bank bailout has worked out pretty well for the big guns, the Wall Street banks that got most of the money and most of the press. But it turns out that smaller banks that got government money haven't quite recovered as well. Marketplace's Heidi Moore reports.
When you walk down Main Street in a small town and see all those vacant storefronts, you're not just looking at empty space. You're seeing a loan that didn't get paid back, probably to a small bank. Add up all those Main Streets, and you have a sense of why a lot of community banks still haven't returned the government money they got from the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. Fred Cannon is an analyst for Keefe, Bruyette & Woods.
What's happening under the surface is there's still almost 600 banks that still have TARP investments, smaller institutions that took TARP during the financial crisis, and in many cases haven't been able to pay it back yet, in part because they're still struggling as an aftermath of the crisis.
That's because small banks hold about a third of their loans in commercial real estate, all those empty storefronts. That's a much higher percentage than the Citigroups and J.P. Morgans of the world. Chris Whalen, founder of Institutional Risk Analytics, believes that TARP gave small banks and their communities false hope.
A lot of those taxpayer funds were used to prop up mediocre institutions, institutions that should have gotten bought or restructured.
Some small banks took government aid to buy up rivals. But so far, 10 banks that received TARP funds have gone out of business.
We have seen a handful of banks who received TARP fail, and I suspect we'll see a handful more of the banks who received TARP not make it.
Whalen's solution? He wants communities to rally around their banks.
The small bank that is strong, they want to do business with you right now. So you should go talk to them.
I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
You're probably not going to notice much when you turn on your TV tomorrow morning, other than maybe that the peacock is gone from the logo. But behind the scenes at NBC, things are going to be very different. Comcast's $14 billion takeover of NBC Universal becomes official tomorrow. It pairs a huge media distribution powerhouse, that'd be Comcast, with a media content workhorse in NBC. Marketplace's Janet Babin explores what consumers might expect from that merger.
Programming-wise, the Comcast takeover is expected to restore NBC after a string of primetime fiascos. Editor Matthew Bellany at The Hollywood Reporter says NBC has gone from first place to worst place in 6 years.
They had a failed experiment last year putting Jay Leno on at 10 o'clock, which eviscerated their ratings and caused the affiliates to revolt and say that they wouldn't carry the network.
Comcast already fired NBC's programming chief. The new guy is from Showtime. So Bellany expects we'll see racier content on the new NBC Universal, something like Showtime's latest hit, Shameless. It's about an alcoholic father and his motherless kids.
We may not have much, but we know how to party.
You're not going to see nudity and profanity on NBC, but you might see shows that push the envelope a little bit more.
This takeover pushes the envelope in other ways, too. There's never been a merger of such a dominant cable and internet company that will now also control so much content. Sasha Meinrath's director of the New America Foundation's Open Technology Initiative. He says Comcast could make it difficult for subscribers to, say, stream movies or TV shows from Netflix.
They don't make money off of other people's content. They make money when you watch their content. And so they have this incentive to prevent you from watching other people's content.
Meinrath expects more of these mergers as distribution and content companies link to compete against the new NBC Universal. And he says the reduced competition will lead to higher cable and internet bills. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
That financial crisis report was pretty much a non-event on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland today, there were panel discussions on financial reform in the Eurozone, how to control the spread of chronic diseases, and what American businesses ought to be doing about climate change. The global green economy will be featured tomorrow morning as well when a new eco-label is unveiled, Wind Made. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
I just moved back to the States last summer, and I'm still adjusting to two things. One, the overuse of LOL. And two, all these eco-labels, hormone-free, organic, nature's friend, and now wind-made. But Morten Albeck at Danish wind company Vestas says this one is different. It's the first ever clean energy seal of approval.
It can be a wind-made car, wind-made undershirts, to Windmade cell phones.
Vestas leads the Windmade campaign. Here's how it works. You're in the shampoo aisle, and you spot a bottle with the blue circle logo.
And besides that, it will state how much wind energy has been used to producing this product. Let's say 28% or 56%. You can also have a shampoo producer who's actually chosen to go all in, the full Monty, 100%.
His polling suggests shampoo buyers around the world are game, but green energy tends to cost more, so Windmade products may have to compete on more than price. Josh Saunders at the product rating group Good Guide thinks one eco label has pulled it off, Energy Star.
There's a financial incentive to the consumer to buy an Energy Star product because it will save them money on their home electric bills.
Appeal to people's greed, not their altruism. And you need a good product, says Aaron Kramer, co-author of Sustainable Excellence.
All products have to succeed based on price, quality, accessibility, and even the wow factor. If green is seen to get in the way of those things, it won't become mainstream.
The Windmade Consortium wants 1,000 brands to commit to green energy by next year. Could be blowing smoke. But the bigger the market, the faster the innovation, says UCLA economist Matthew Kahn.
Companies that focus on solar and wind power can be more confident of this sort of field of dreams effect, that if they come up with cheaper ways to produce wind and solar power, that they have a commitment from these firms to buy it.
Windmade logo products will appear later this year. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
New Yorkers are a group about which this can safely be said. They have seen it all, maybe twice, which is why the scene outside Macy's in Herald Square yesterday is worth noting. Presumably jaded passersby stopped to stare at an advertising stunt. A comedian named Mike Birbiglia will be living in a display window at Macy's for an entire week, eating, sleeping, playing Xbox, that kind of thing. It's a living, breathing ad for Macy's and Downy Fabric Softener. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
Comedian Mike Birbiglia's temporary home? A 6-by-18-foot display window. Before moving in, Birbiglia gave a press conference in his pajamas.
I'm the worst sleeper in America, and as a result, I'm the face of the Clean Sheet Week Challenge.
Downy aims to prove that softer, sweet-smelling sheets can help this famous insomniac sleep. Macy's hopes the campaign will boost bedding sales.
Hi, how are you?
Birbiglia's display window is mostly filled by a huge bed. Downy logos are everywhere.
This is like a first New York apartment size.
That's exactly what it is. Look at these crazy people waving at me.
Birbiglia may be bad at sleeping, but he's great at social media, and that's a big part of this campaign. Birbiglia is answering questions online and blogging.
I'm tweeting, and I'm on Facebook. The whole of my responsibility is just to kind of react to what is happening.
The comedian has 57,000 followers on Twitter and 34,000 Facebook fans. Thanks to him and his sleep problems, Downey's social media presence has taken off overnight. Downey's Sarah Pasquinucci.
We've grown our fan base on Facebook more than we ever hoped.
Since they announced the campaign, Downey's doubled its Facebook fan base to more than 100,000. More and more traditional companies are starting to invest in this kind of advertising, says Josh Burnoff, author of social marketing book Groundswell.
When they succeed, they're quite cost effective. You can get your own customers to actually be the ones spreading your messages.
This is about more than building brand awareness. Consultant Shell Holtz points out that if people want to check out what Birbiglia is doing, they have to go to Downey's Facebook page and push the like button. That not only gives Downey a slew of personal information about the consumer, it flags that person to receive online ads from Downey.
That gives you a channel through which you can be made aware of specials and offers and discounts.
One day in, 15,000 people have liked Downey's Mike in the Window campaign. And outside of Macy's, it's getting attention, too. Shakina Mitchell stopped to check out the display.
I saw him in a window, and I was just wondering, you know, what was going on.
Are you going to check him out online?
Yeah, I'm going to tell people about this. They're going to be like, you're lying. I'm like, no, for real. He's in the window. Posted this on my Facebook.
Marketing mission accomplished. And even better for Downey, Birbiglia told Facebook fans today that he slept, quote, pretty good. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, letting trash go to waste.
You're literally throwing money and energy into a big pit in the ground.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials picked up 4 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 11,989. The NASDAQ tacked on 15 points, just over a 0.5%, finished at 2755. The S&P 500 added 2 points, 0.2%, ended at 1299. A mixed bag of corporate earnings buffeted the markets today. Shares of Caterpillar plowed forward 0.9%. The company reported profits jumped 400% on global demand for mining and construction equipment. Time Warner Cable wired up a gain of nearly 1.75%. An increase in internet subscribers helped offset losses in TV customers. AT&T earnings beat estimates, but shares disconnected 2% after the company reported that new wireless contracts fell to the lowest level in 5 years. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.39%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by iShares Exchange-Traded Funds. Learn more about their ETFs at 1-800-iShares or iShares.com. iShares, keep evolving. Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing partner to 4 million small businesses with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/grow. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department releases its advance estimate gross domestic product report for the fourth quarter. Health advocates are gathered for an annual health action conference continuing on Capitol Hill. President Obama is scheduled to speak. And tomorrow is Data Privacy Day. Organizers say it's an international celebration of the dignity of the individual expressed through personal information. Possible 24-hour Facebook fast? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. A friend of mine told me the other day that there's a saying in the Arab world that as Egypt goes, so goes the rest of the Middle East. She's Egyptian, so she's not entirely objective, but it rings true, and it does help explain why so many people, including a whole lot of policymakers in the American government, have been watching the events in Egypt so closely this week. Commentator Mona El-Tahawi says the protests in Egypt and elsewhere in the region have much in common.
It's referred to as the youth bulge, the Arab world's unprecedented share of youth between the ages of 15 to 29. And that bulge seems to be morphing into an earthquake. Young people, frustrated at unemployment and political repression, have fueled a revolution in Tunisia and organized unprecedented protests in Egypt. Algeria, Yemen, and Jordan have had their share of protests too. Unemployment is an especially acute concern. Official statistics in Tunisia put it at 14%, but analysts say it's closer to 35%. The state there, as in many Arab countries, has not been able to create enough jobs to keep up with population growth. Positive economic indices often mask the lack of trickle-down. Protesters in both the Tunisian uprising as well as in Egypt chanted against the corruption of their rulers. Imagine being a 25-year-old Egyptian. You take advantage of your country's free university education, but you're crammed into lecture halls along with thousands of other students. You wonder how useful your degree will be once you hit the job market. the state which had once guaranteed your parents and their entire generation jobs couldn't even pretend to want to do the same with you if it tried. You feel like your life is on hold. No job, no money, and no freedom. Those who can leave for opportunities abroad, and those who remain are in danger of slipping into despair. The U.S. is an ally to many regimes in the Middle East and North Africa. It gives Egypt millions in aid every year. And what Middle East youth question is its support for governments that have done nothing to open up economic opportunities. This is an issue that should resonate with many in the U.S. How do you deal with long-term unemployment? How do you face economic uncertainty? And how to plan for a future without a job on the horizon? So unless Washington pushes its allies in the region to open up both politically as well as economically, it will be resented along with those governments.
Mona El-Tahawi is a syndicated columnist. You can send us your thoughts online, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell is putting his money where his mouth is. Goodell has promised to take a pay cut from $10 million a year down to a single buck if the negotiations that the league is in the middle of now with the Players Association fail and there's a work stoppage later this spring. Goodell thus joins the long list of top executives who've volunteered to work on the cheap. Marketplace's Steve Henn has more.
The idea of taking just a dollar a year in salary has a long history. It goes back to the World Wars, when captains of industry volunteered to help retool the American economy for war.
To fight this war, 10 million more people must go to work by the end of 1943.
It was illegal for the U.S. government to pay these industrialists absolutely nothing, so they accepted just a dollar a year. Then, in the late 70s, Lee Iacocca brought this concept to Chrysler, which was teetering on the edge of bankruptcy.
I have one and only one ambition for Chrysler, to be the best. What else is there?
Turns out, a lot. By 1986, Iacocca had turned Chrysler around. And that year, he took home more than $20 million in stock options, becoming America's highest paid CEO. Tax expert David K. Johnston says in the early 90s, changes in U.S. tax law made performance-based compensation plans even more popular in corner offices.
Congress passed a law that said you couldn't deduct an executive's salary, base salary, of more than $1 million, but you could deduct unlimited amounts of money paid for performance.
So today, for many CEOs, their base salary has become as insignificant as a rounding error. Members of the Dollar a Year Club include billionaires like Apple's Steve Jobs and Google's Eric Schmidt and Larry Page. So no matter what happens with a looming strike at the NFL, the league's commissioner, Roger Goodell, is probably betting on a big bonus someday down the line. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The Dollar a Year Club is bigger than you think. Read more on our website, marketplace.org. Every year in this country, we create about 250 million tons of trash. Municipal solid waste is the EPA's term. It's a bit more than 4 pounds of garbage per person per day. And all of it has to go someplace once it's picked up at the curb on collection days. Mostly, our trash goes into landfills. And as it happens, the biggest landfill in the United States is not far from downtown Los Angeles. It takes in 13,000 tons of garbage a day, but it's filling up. It's going to have to close in 2 years. Unless we can put our waste to work. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
There are people who look at garbage and don't see garbage. They see an untapped resource. Just ask this guy.
Though I may be trash, I am anything but useless.
That would be Mr. Trash. He's an animated milk carton that greets you when you visit
the Commerce Refuse to Energy Facility. Come on along!
Commerce is a city just south of Los Angeles and the site of a 25-year-old program that turns trash into electricity, enough to power about 15,000 homes at any given time. I leave Mr. Trash and get a real tour.
Hey, wait a minute! I'm still talking!
Garbage trucks dump their loads into a pit, and a giant claw picks up huge, smelly mouthfuls. There's packaging, a ream of carpet that unravels endlessly, some old shirts and blue jeans.
And actually, we like fabric because it burns cleanly and it burns pretty hot.
Plant engineer Jonathan Iorga shows me the huge furnace where it all gets burned. I look through a tiny window into a 30-foot cavern of orange flame. It's the biggest fire I've ever seen.
Whoa. That's our own little man-made Dante's Inferno.
And is that just burning all day, all night?
All day, all night.
And the heat powers turbines that make electricity. The plant sells it to the local utility, says Iorga, and that makes the operation about break-even.
It's a power plant that's instead of using fossil fuel, it uses trash for its fuel.
But the technology never really took off in the state or across the U.S., according to Vivian Thompson. She studies trash policy at the University of Virginia and says there were a couple reasons for that. One was toxicity.
The fear over dioxins and furans.
Fears that were overblown because of the ghosts of old, dirty incinerators. The other factor was harder to overcome.
We have loads of land.
Thompson says instead of innovating with trash, the U.S. has opened mega landfills farther away from city centers. She says that's a shame.
You're literally throwing money and energy into a big pit in the ground. There are dollars in trash. Trash is energy.
While the U.S. has dug deeper pits, Japan, Germany, and other nations in Europe have built hundreds of trash power plants, even in the middle of neighborhoods.
We saw one in Japan that they used the heating process to heat water and built a community pool with it. Another one built a senior citizen center next door to the plant.
That's Los Angeles City Council member Greg Smith. He took a sort of world tour of trash to energy plants, and he wrote an epic report that's earned him a nickname.
Mr. Trash, and not something politicians aspire to, but...
Smith's pushing Southern California to take another look at waste to energy and to build three new plants using new methods, like boiling trash in big metal vessels.
What comes out of it usually is a very fine compost that you can use in agricultural purposes.
The technology does cost a lot up front. But over time, L.A. County will have to haul its waste farther and farther into the desert. That's going to cost a lot more, too. But Smith says a potentially bigger obstacle than the money is public opinion. Americans simply don't want their trash in their own backyards. He says more real-world examples of the technology could convert the public.
You bring people in, you show them what you're doing, you let them go in and see it, touch it, feel it, and walk out saying, you know what, this isn't so bad after all.
Our animated milk carton Mr. Trash is certainly happy with his conversion.
You know what? I like this higher state of existence because no one can call me useless trash anymore.
In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Trow for Marketplace. Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes today, first of all, a correction. It was Willie Sutton, not John Dillinger, who said he robs banks because that's where the money is. And now a commentary on the fleeting nature of real estate booms. Back in the good old days, like what, 6 or 7 years ago, the economy in Dubai was going so strong that the government's investment fund decided to create more real estate. It piled sand upon sand to build palm tree-shaped islands offshore in the Persian Gulf. Also a collection of islands shaped like a map of the world, built them as luxury resorts. Well, given time and the nature of nature, the waters are reclaiming what is rightfully theirs. A lawsuit filed in Dubai says the islands are sinking back into the sea. Not that it really matters much. Only Greenland, for what it's worth, was inhabited anyway. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 4 points, less than a 10%. The Nasdaq tacked on 15 points, just over 0.5%. The S&P 500 added 2 points, 0.2%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, small banks learn to compete by being more than just banks.
Every month we hold a wee bowling night. We just took on some homeowner association meetings, the Metropolitan Youth Symphony that will be performing down here.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.